This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Hello and welcome to another great show, Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC. Man, do we have a fun interview for you today. This young man and I have worked together off and on for over 30 years at least. He has been in comedy and then out of comedy, then back into comedy, and he's got a great story. He is a regular on stages around the country. He used to help with my open mics and MC my shows, and just a great guy. So let's get him on here. Ladies and gentlemen, please, a big round of applause, my comedy friend, Jim Ferrell.
Hey, Scotty,
Jim,
how are you?
Jim, so good to have you on the show finally. We have known each other a long time, but it took a while to get this interview set up because you're a busy, busy guy. Jim, how are you today?
I am fantastic. I got a day off, and yeah, I got a pretty hecky schedule, but yeah, this is fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Jim has been a part of my comedy life for since back in the 80s. Well, maybe you should tell that end of it. What kind of got you into comedy, Jim? What drove you to the stage?
Well, I started off as a fan of comedy. I always loved it, and I remember back even when I was a kid, like in high school, we'd be out in the front yard playing football, and then I'd have my mom, you know, when she was watching the old Mike Douglas show or Merv Griffin, I said, when the stand-up comic comes on, come out and get me. And I'd run in the house and watch the comics, and back then it was Franklin Ajayi and George Miller and, you know, obviously George Carlin and Pryor, all those guys. And then once they were done, I'd go back out and play, start playing football again. So I was always a fan. I came down to your club many, many times before I started doing it. And I just wanted to try it one time. And, you know, at some point I got the courage to do it, but I wasn't terribly confident. So the first couple of times I went on stage, I actually did juggling.
I don't remember that. And also, I didn't know that you were a customer before you were a comic at the club. I know you're from this area, but that's interesting. Well, I happen to live in a house that comedy built, so thank you for your small part of my house. So what year would that be?
Well, when I started?
Yeah, that you were coming to the club and then got the courage to get on stage. And did you appear at one of the open mics or take one of the comedy schools that was being run by Karen and Del Van Dyke?
No, this was long before that. I started, I think my first set was probably around 87 down at the old Metro. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I did your contest one year where I actually did juggle. And I got fourth. I was one place from moving on to the next round. And boy, I was pissed at you.
Well, I wasn't the judge per se, but what he's referencing is we used to do a regular competition called the Great Northern California Comedy Competition. And it was really a cheap way for me as a producer to see a lot of different talent because people would come from all over the state to perform in this because we had cash prizes and more work for people. But were you juggling for a long time before this? Was that something you did in school or something?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I was in high school and I went down to Fisherman's Wharf one day and saw the guys. And so I figured I just spent one summer doing it. And I figured this is going to be a great way to get girls. Didn't work. You know, my friends were giving me a bad time, like juggling, that's boy, that's kind of gay, isn't it? And I'm like, no, juggling's cool. And then I remember one of my first patterns I learned was a four ball shower. And I thought, well, okay, maybe.
Boom, there's a little joke there. That's interesting, you know, doing juggling to meet girls. I think that's very funny. When you went down to the wharf, you probably saw some of our old friends. Fred Anderson was a regular down there and others. So you did comedy. Now, it was not just juggling. I'm sure you did some material.
Yeah, there was some material. And I think my philosophy at the time was, you know, if the jokes don't work, at least, you know, they're being entertained somehow. So I did that for a while, and then I kind of slowly got rid of the props and started doing stand up. And I don't know if I did a second competition, because eventually I got booked by you. I did a lot of the emceeing on the weekends. Classic Scott story. You know, I'd get $20 for each show that I hosted. And on the weekends, I hosted two shows, and I got 20 for the first show and 15 for the second. Never figured out your math, but.
Well, there's a bit of a reputation for me being cheap, but I treated you well.
You did. Absolutely. No, it was, look, your club in the heyday was, I mean, I didn't play every club in the country, but my gosh, that old Sack location had to be one of the best clubs in the country. That place on early show Saturday, and, you know, every night, but, you know, it was just incredible. I mean, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, we were pretty lucky. We got a chance to design that room. It had a low ceiling. We had people right up against the stage. We had three-tiered seating, so everybody, it was like arena seating. Everybody had a good view. It was a gem on the tours. I'm proud to say it was fun to work. But as a, you're right, as a opening act MC, you could get a lot more work from a producer like me because one, you were good, two, you were clean, and three, you were consistent, which for a producer is so important. And I'm sure getting all that work on stage helped you hone your act.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And I remember, you know, you're young and you're doing comedy and the problem is when you're first doing comedy, you're thinking about your set, right? And you're not performing it. So there was one time where I got 3 weeks of comedy back to back. And the last week was at your club. I was at, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then I was in Tucson, Arizona. And then the third week I was at your club. And I remember by the time I got to laughs, I had my act down so good that I didn't even have to think about it. Now I could perform. Now I can write on stage and actually not worry about what the next joke was. So stage time is, you know, incredibly important for that reason, amongst many others. But that to me was the big takeaway.
Yeah, it gives you the confidence, I think, to play on stage because you know you can bring the audience back. And that's something that's just so valuable. And you can't just buy that. You have to earn that with time and hard work. I'm glad that worked out. Now, you were a regular road comic for how long, Jim?
Well, after I was with you, I moved down to LA and was writing for about, I was down there about 2 years, I guess. And, you know, good buddy of yours, Steve Bruner, he and I did a lot of freelance writing together. So when I was in LA, I did mostly local stuff down there. But then when I moved to San Francisco in 93, then I was doing a lot more road work. I was there for 9 years and I was emceeing a lot of the showcases at Cobb's. I would, you know, I was opening act at Cobb's 2 to 3 times a year, Punchline a couple times a year, Rooster Teeth Feathers. And then I would go do the road up in Oregon and Washington. So that was probably, you know, close to 9 years.
Anytime you commit a decade of your life to something, that makes you a professional. You were obviously making enough money to get by, and working all those different stages, all those different audiences, was really what you know, chisels that coal into a diamond when it comes to comedy entertainment. Congratulations on that. You also, I know, had a chance to work with some pretty amazing people, not only at my club, but at other clubs. Who was it that stood out, or was there anybody that you really looked to that gave you an idea of the right path to take your stand-up comedy?
Yeah, I don't know that there was. I certainly had people that I looked up to in the early days. It was, you know, one of the coolest things about one of the weeks with you is I was out at the Birdcage or Citrus club. And it was one of those weeks where you had three different pretty big headliners. And I want to say I was hosting that week and there was Pat Paulson, Pete Barbeauty, and Bobby Slayton.
Wow.
And back then, you know, when you were a comic, starting out, it was a big deal to have that, that resume and have who you worked with. And I got to add three names just in 1 week. And that was, you know, People Are Beauty was, and I just remember watching him and the crowd watching him and going, I don't know about this guy. But if you're older, People Are Beauty had been on the Tonight Show countless times. I think he was on the Tonight Show like 20 times. And he was definitely an old school comic, and he was a classic, and he was really fun to watch. But I had more fun watching the crowd try to figure out what he was doing.
Well, people like Soupy Sales, Pat Paulson, People Are Beauty, I used to like to bring in the what were kind of Catskill type comics, old school comics, because they were the foundation of this industry that was really taking off in the 80s and 90s. But these guys were working it back in the 60s and 70s when, you know, it was all strip clubs and jazz clubs. And it was always fascinating to me to see how they had developed and how it's different than it was in the 80s. Of course, it's way different now. But what a great experience. I'm sure you got a chance to meet some other pretty amazing acts. What was some of the great memories you have of working the road at the time?
Well, working I worked with George Lopez a couple of times, and you know, he's a interesting guy, pretty amazing comic. You know, and hanging out and partying with him was interesting. We were at I think the Walnut Creek Punchline one time, and he bought the crowd all a shot of whatever they wanted. It was a slow night apparently, and there wasn't that many people, and that got a little bit out of control. And, so that, that was kind of a odd one. One of the best things I ever did is I was working with, Brian Regan at Cops, and Brian Regan's one of my, I think he's just one of the funniest comics I've ever seen.
Yeah, funny and, guy.
And I've got to play golf with him, and he was equally as funny on the golf course. I mean, he was horrible, but man, it was the best.
Bad the golfer, good comic.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been completely unfair if he's that funny and a great golfer.
That's too much.
But yeah, it was, you know, I worked with, you know, obviously I worked with Bobby Slayton, Brian Regan, Dom Irrera back in the day, Dana Gould, you know, I would host at Cobbs, and that was a great gig because you actually got money, right? You got a dollar for every person that came into the room. And I think that room probably held about, what, 175, would you say? I know you'd been there many times.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd make a pretty good, you know, pretty good night. Plus it was a lot of fun. And three of the nights I was there, Robin Williams came in. And one of the nights who's now my wife, she was with me. It was early in our dating cycle, if that's what you want to call it. And, so she's at the show and we're watching the show and I'm trying to impress her. And all of a sudden, Robin Williams walks in. And, so after the show, he was back at the bar area, hanging out with me and Suzanne. And, you know, she was just like, holy Toledo, this is unbelievable. And so, you know, I bought myself a pass for about 6 months. I couldn't do any wrong because if she got mad at me, I said, look, I introduced you to Robin Williams. So,
well, I think one of that's very funny on a very marriage level, right? That is it, always good to get a few extra kudos in the bag for when we F up like we do, like men do. But one of the things that's interesting about being in any fringe part of show business is the personalities that we get a chance to interact with. And, you know, Robin worked my stage twice. There was a lot of other people we were talking about, Pat Paulson and others, and just the opportunity to breathe the same air as these, you know, comic geniuses and people that really took this craft and honed it into something special. I mean, it can't help but rub off a little bit and learn something from watching that. And I think what you're saying is all that work at Cobbs and all the people you got a chance to work with over the years had to help you develop. I mean, you had a decade of professional comedy work. I mean, that's a real success, Jim. Congrats.
No, thank you. Yeah. I think the big takeaway for me was, you know, just the confidence. Because I think if there was one thing that you know, probably I lacked a little bit is just confidence. And, you know, and I was, you know, doing comedy and I was having some success, but it was never big on like self-promotion. And I just remember, I was looking back, I was thinking about it the other day. And so I was in San Francisco and I got an opportunity and it didn't pan out, you know, but, you know, Wendy Liebman, I worked with her at, what is it in East Bay? Tommy T's. And she came up to me afterwards and she goes, oh my gosh, you're, you know, I think you're really, really funny. If I ever get a sitcom, I'm going to hire, you know, call you to write for me. I'm like, all right, whatever. It's just, you know, people being nice. I didn't think anything of it. And like 3 weeks later, she calls me. She goes, guess what? I got a development deal. Can you work on a pilot for me? I was like, holy Toledo. So yeah. But then a couple of weeks later she called and said the deal fell through. But yeah, I mean, it was weird. I just, you know, I had opportunities. I think I was better than I gave myself credit for. I got a call from Saturday Night Live. They wanted me to submit jokes to Norm MacDonald. And, you know, like we talked about, you know, kind of in the, when you saw me the other night, that was a true story. I was just like, man, I just got to a point where I was done. And, I'm probably jumping ahead a little bit in the conversation, but yeah, I mean, I just had a lot of really nice opportunities and I wish I would have taken advantage of more of them, but I had to do what was right for me at the time.
So stand-up comedy did open up some doors, gave you some opportunities, but at a certain point after 10 years and not really getting that maybe career level, especially financially, it's difficult. Only a handful of people really make a full life's career out of comedy and make enough money to raise a family and stuff. Now, I alluded it a little bit earlier, but you transitioned into wine and became a wine expert. You're a high-level sommelier. Why don't you walk us through real quick how that happened? What got you interested in wine?
Well, when I moved to San Francisco, you know Rick Clay, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we were, you know, casual friends at the time. And he's like, oh, you got to come down to San Francisco. If you want, I can get you a job at my liquor store. And I said, all right, well, yeah. So, you know, when I went down there, I started working there. Well, this liquor store turned out to be the K&L Wines, which is, you know, one of the top wine stores in the country. And so they were really cool about letting me do the road. If I needed to take a week or two off, I could do it. They were really flexible working around my comedy schedule. So it was just perfect. I got to, you know, keep the proverbial day job, but still do, you know, as much comedy as I wanted. So yeah, I just started there and, you know, I never really had a huge interest in wine, but it paid the bills and, you know, I was picking up some stuff along the way and got pretty good about, you know, with wine without really trying. But when I moved back up here, you know, I had to figure out what I was going to do. And, you know, I thought, you know, I'm making a lot more money selling wine than I was selling jokes. So, I decided I'd better get serious about wine. So what I did at that time is I just started taking some courses and went through the Accord of Sommeliers and then went through the Society of Wine Educators and just did a lot of home study. And took the tests, and I got to certified wine educator through the Society of Wine Educators and the first two levels of the Court of Sommeliers. So yeah, I know more than most, not as much as some. And if you ever want somebody to come to your party and shut it down early, invite me, and I'll start talking about wine and bore the hell out of everybody.
Well, it's so funny because you're breezing through it in about a minute and a half of conversation, but really you pivoted from stand-up comedy to selling wine to becoming a wine expert. It took years and a lot of hard work and study. What can you explain to the audience briefly what it takes to become a sommelier?
Yeah, there's the test involves three different components. There's a theory, which is basically a written task, questions. There is tableside service, and you also have to open a bottle of champagne and not make any noise when you open it and then pour. They just give you instructions. So basically what I'd done is I read my materials, made flashcards, studied my tail off for the theory part. I remember my wife getting very irritated because on my kitchen table, I had 2,000 flashcards. and you know, I have a pile called France and then a pile called Bordeaux, you know, sub regions of France. And then I had an Italy pile, and then I had an Australia, south of, you know, a Chile, Argentina pile, Germany pile. And all these were what grapes grow in certain areas and what are the regulations and, you know, what are the grapes of Burgundy? What are the five major regions of Burgundy? What are the 13 sub regions of Côte de Beaune and the, you know, 17 sub regions of Côte de Nuit and all this stuff that just, you know, is fascinating to me, but boring. Right. So yeah, I studied for that test for 9 months. And then, so you sit down and the first thing they do is they give you, a couple wines and one white and one red. You have a sheet in front of you where you have to, and let me see if I can remember this right. This was many years ago when I took the exam, but the sheet has, you have to identify the tannin levels, the alcohol levels, the sugar level, and the acidity level on a, like a 1 to 5 scale. And then you have to identify 3 fruit descriptors, 3 wood descriptors, and 3 earth descriptors. So you may be having a Chardonnay, or, you know, if it's a Chardonnay, you got to figure out, okay, the acidity level is probably, I'm going to say it's pretty high. It's, I'm going to give it a 4. Tannins are going to be really low because there's no tannins in white wines except for what might come from the barrel. Then you got to figure out the sugar level. Okay, it's dry. And then, you know, and then you move on to the different types of fruits. And then you have to kind of your final conclusion where you have to say old world versus new world, country, and then grape varietal.
Wow.
And so you do this kind of by deduction, right? It's not so much that you taste this wine and you know exactly what it is. And that certainly can happen. But knowing, this is where the theory part comes in, is I'm going to say this wine is got really high acid. It is tree fruit. You know, you might get some apple. You might get some pear. The alcohol is a little low. So I'm going to say this is an old world wine. Okay. So now you've eliminated half the world, right? So now you know, this wine has to be from somewhere, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, now you got to figure out, okay, maybe this is a Chardonnay. Well, where in Europe does Chardonnay grow? Well, Chardonnay doesn't grow everywhere in Europe. So now you're thinking, okay, this has to be, you know, Burgundy is going to be the obvious choice because that's, for the most part, the only white wine that they grow there. So you might say old world is your conclusion. It's going to be from France. It's going to be from Burgundy, and it's going to be a Chardonnay. And it's going to be a 19 or 2008, you know, a couple of years old. It's not an old wine because you can tell by the color. So yeah, that's basically how it works. And
wow. You know, I'm going to interrupt. You're basically a wine detective. So it's not so much memorizing each and every wine because there's thousands of them, but what you're doing is breaking down what created the wine. And then as a detective, you're searching out which each wine, the properties it has, and that helps you become the wine expert that you are.
Yeah, it's kind of what they even call it, a deductive tasting, right? So, yeah, so you're basically going to figure out what the wine is not. And then you kind of go through your head and you eliminate. Okay, so you get a white wine. Okay, well, I know it's not Cabernet. I know it's not Merlot, right? So now you're thinking it's going to be Chardonnay, Pinot Grigio, Sauvignon Blanc, Viognier, Roussanne, Marsanne. You know, the major grape varietals, and they're in these tests. They're not going to give you some goofy wine that no one's heard of. They're going to keep the wines to classic varietals, the classic regions. You're not going to get a Cabernet from Fresno, right? I mean, it's going to be,
well. I mean, so you've learned there's this education aspect. Did you learn to enjoy wine? I mean, is it something that you would have been drinking anyway, or did all this knowledge kind of take you down that path of enjoying wines of various types?
No, I think just what I did took me down that path, and I really enjoy it. I still do. I mean, you know, there's a famous quote by somebody, I don't remember his name, but he said, wine does not grow in ugly areas. So, you know, usually if you're in a wine growing region, you're in a pretty cool place. Unless of course it's, you know, Fresno, but
well, for, you know, all of our international listeners, Fresno is exactly as he states.
This wine thing has taken me to Europe a couple different times. I've been to Germany, I've been to Portugal, I've been to Spain, I've been to France, I've been to Italy.
That's so cool. I didn't know you got all that travel out of it. That's amazing.
Yeah. No, and we spent, you know, 16, 17 hours a day at wineries and eating and tasting wine. And it's, you know, it's an amazing trip. It's a bit much, to be honest with you, because they, you know, they figure, hey, we're paying you. We're going to get, you know, the money out of you. But it's obviously an amazing experience.
Well, to go to these. You didn't stay with K&L Wines. You developed as a sommelier. You got your knowledge levels up. You've actually moved your way up the corporate ladder. Who do you represent now?
I work for a retailer called Total Wines and More. There's about 250 stores throughout the country, and they're basically like Costco of wine. We have, the stores are about 30,000 to 40,000 square feet. We got 8,500 different wines.
Wow.
We have probably 4,000 spirits and like 3,000 beers.
How many sommeliers would a company like Wines and More have?
Not necessarily a lot. We have our own in-store program called the Total Wine Professional. That's a series of 7 exams. So although there are plenty of people in the company who are certified sommeliers, there's a lot of people who kind of just started with not a ton of wine knowledge and worked their way up and are working through the in-house program. So it's 7 tests that consist of a California test, Washington, Oregon, and then there's a France test, and then there's a Bordeaux test that it's its own thing. There's a Southern Hemisphere test. There is a dessert wine and champagne test, and then there's, I think, Italian test. I don't know if I mentioned that already. And then the rest of the, it's a pretty intense program.
Well, I think that that's a great opportunity for the employees of the company, but I also was trying to get to the point that this large successful corporation that sells wine looks to somebody like you as the education leader. I mean, there's not a lot of, world-class sommeliers working for this company. So you become a very important part of that industry, and that has had to have brought you a lot of financial and personal success.
Oh yeah, no, it's been great. I'm the trainer for this region. So whenever there's wine and spirits classes, I'm the one that, does the education for it. Financially, yeah, it's been good. A lot of this when I first started, cause there was a gap in between, K&L and Total Wines where I worked for BevMo. And there was a point where I decided to do all this stuff because I wanted to make myself I wanted to make it hard for them to get rid of me. So I figured I'm going to kind of create my own path here and, you know, become a wine specialist, become a sommelier, and that way the company's going to think, you know, long and hard about who they're going to get rid of.
Well, you made yourself valuable to the company, and you improved your own education, your own level of expertise. So it really was a win-win. And I think most of the people, at least in Northern California, have heard of BevMo, and of course, Total Wines and More is where Jill and I shop. You know, having that background and having that career line, here we are a couple decades later, and you've built quite a successful career, yet you've pivoted again. And I know that you've been doing some writing classes with our friend Steve Bruner. You've been performing. I just saw you Sunday at the Punchline as you're back on stage and performing. So what brought you back to stand-up comedy? Because you had a nice 10-year career, then you've had a couple decades as a successful wine expert. What's bringing you back into comedy?
I think the bigger question was what got me out of comedy. Because I've always loved writing and I love performing, but I just got to an age and a place where when I was in San Francisco that I was like, okay, I need to move. And you know, I've done San Francisco, right? And I need to move to LA, or I need to move to New York, or I need to go, you know, move back to SAC. And I'd bought a house up here a few years prior. My girlfriend was up here and she was wanting me to move. And, you know, I was just kind of tired of San Francisco. I had done everything I could do there. And so I decided, yeah, I need to go. I need to grow up. Being a starving artist at 24 is cool. At 34, it's a little sad, but at 44, downright dreadful. And I was, you know, approaching 40 at the time. So I just said, I'm going to move back up to SAC. And if comedy is meant to be, I'm going to probably do it at some point. But I need to get established. I need to get a career, basically.
And that led to you being a sommelier. But how, now that you've been that, what's pulling you back on stage? Just that enjoyment of writing and performing?
Yeah. I'm enjoying myself more than I ever have. You know, that confidence that maybe I didn't have enough of when I was younger, I have plenty of it now. And I think it's just, you get to an age where you're like, I don't care if they don't like me. I'm going to go home to my nice house. And, you know, I got plenty of, you know, I'm not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but I just don't have the fears that I did when I was, you know, 32.
So just to encapsulate that, what you've done is you've reached a point in life by age and financial security that playing with stand-up comedy, which was a first love, is something you can go back to without the strains and stresses of money and time. And you've always enjoyed writing and performing. Are you planning to follow the path of getting back on stage and performing live, or do you want to stay doing more writing and stuff?
I want to perform, you know, and I'd like to write too. So, I mean, I have, you know, what I'm doing is I'm putting together, you know, I don't want to get together in a 45-minute set, and I'm working on that now. And I have a 3-year plan because, you know, in 3 years, I'm going to probably cut to part-time work. And at that point, I want to be in a position where, whether I have a set strong enough to get on Sirius satellite radio or, you know, start traveling a little bit. But right now I'm just having fun, and I do want to keep performing, and I don't really have any expectations. You know, like I said, everything, all my basic needs are taken care of. So, you know, I want to have fun. I'm more confident than I've ever been. On stage.
That's so important, and congratulations on not only your decade of comedy success back in the 80s and 90s, but what you've done, the work and effort that you put in to become a wine sommelier and have such a great career with Total Wines and More. And I want to support you, as I did coming out and seeing you Sunday, in getting back into comedy. And it is nice when you reach our age that you can start focusing on what you enjoy. And for me, it's stand-up comedy, and that led to this podcast and reconnecting with friends like you. And I can tell that you've got that itch again to get back on stage, kind of sharpen your comedy chops and have some fun with it. And I think that's so important. So congratulations and all that. Now we're going into the end of 2022 and into 2023. You mentioned that you have kind of a 3-year plan. Do you have any special shows coming up or anything that you're looking forward to as a comedian?
I'm actually going to be up on April 1st. I'm going to be working with you on a fundraiser up in Placerville. And then I also will be at the Punchline on the 6th. And right now, that's about the only things I have on the books other than doing another one of those classes in May.
Well, that's terrific. And I'm so glad that we got a chance to share your story. I've kind of followed your career both in comedy and in the wine world. And it's always fascinated me, one, because I enjoy a good glass of wine, and two, because you were able to really have two strong careers one in entertainment and one in retail sales and in wine. And that's not something that everybody can successfully say they've done in their life. So congratulations on that. And congratulations on getting back on stage and having fun with it. That's so important to enjoy yourself. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been great hearing Jim's story. Keep an eye out for him. Jim Farrell will be live on stage at a club near you soon. And hopefully there'll be some writing in your future.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm writing almost daily right now. So
that's great. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed this great interview with Jim Farrell. Stay tuned next week. We'll have another wonderful show. And thanks for listening. Jim, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun, Scott.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that interview with sommelier Jim Farrell. But he also, I wanted to get a little bit of his stand-up comedy. So here's Jim sharing some of his recently written material, just so that we have a little stand-up on this interview show. And here comes Jim Farrell sharing some of his comedy. Enjoy.
Hey, thanks, guys. So I moved from San Francisco to Sacramento to get married, and I married into a family that's a little more conservative than I'm used to. Done a lot of things for the first time. I went to see my first country music show. Scott, do you love the country music?
That's funny.
I don't know if you guys love country music or not, but I hate country music. Hate country music for one reason, and that's because it all sounds the same. And that's why I listen to reggae. I'm no dummy. I got both the albums. So my brother-in-law took me shooting. He's a big gun guy, and I don't really want to get in the big gun debate right now. But I will say I'm against guns for home protection, only because I don't want to spend $500 on something I hope I never have to use. I spend $500 on a gun, I'm shooting somebody. If I want to spend a lot of money on something I'm not going to use, I'm buying a book.
Yeah.
I'm buying broccoli and I'm buying running shoes, so you get the idea. But, you know, moving into a nice neighborhood was a little bit different. In San Francisco, the neighbors were friendly enough, but we just kind of stayed to ourselves. Now I'm in the suburbs and everybody wants to be your friend. And I got one neighbor who is constantly bringing me fruits and vegetables. And, you know, I'm leaving it on my porch every day. I come home and there's a pile of zucchini. And it's like, what, you couldn't throw it away? Thanks for giving me a chore.
Oh.
So.
What are neighbors for, right?
Exactly. I married a Hispanic gal, and probably not the most traditional Hispanic woman I've ever met. She's got one kid. She doesn't speak the language, and the house is a mess. 30 million cleaning women in California, and I get the one that doesn't clean.
Right, right. Well, I get it. And Suzanne, I'm sure, loves that joke.
Oh, she really enjoys it. And I'm happy to, be with Suzanne because she's wonderful. Because I was younger, I really wasn't, didn't have a lot of confidence with women. Getting a girl's phone number was a lot like playing the lottery. The chances of all seven numbers being right were about 1 in 20 million.
Well, that's great. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there was a little stand-up comedy by Jim Farrell. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Scott.
All right. Well, we've had a good interview and a little bit of comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for this week's show. And next week, another great show for you. Hey, thanks for listening. Be sure to share and rate when you can. We'll see you soon. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand-Up Comedy, your host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.